Okay, so we've got one more session before lunch, and the moderator will be Dana Small. Dana is a colleague of mine. We were together here at the Neuro. She did her PhD in psychology under Marilyn Jones Gottman, and is now at Yale University, where she's doing really seminal work on the brain imaging signature of obesity, and she will chair our session.
Good afternoon, everybody, or evening, depending on your working time zone. It's an honor to chair this session. We have three outstanding speakers. Just before we get started, I'm asked to remind you that we're running a little bit late. Your gut peptides have probably signaled to your hypothalamus, which is telling your prefrontal cortex you're a little hungry. I don't want to take any time away from the speakers, so I'm going to limit the questions and ask you to, if you don't get to ask your question, to ask the speakers after the session. So our first speaker is Professor Charles Spence, who is head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory and professor in the Department of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University. His work focuses on understanding how sensory inputs combine to produce multisensory percepts, creating and hoping to create a better and hopefully more healthful design of multisensory foods, products, interfaces, and environments. He is the recipient of numerous awards and author of over 250 papers. And the title of his talk, which has changed, is Crossmodal Processing, Insights for Healthy Multisensory Design, Packaging, and Branding.
So the neurophysiology org got dropped. I did a request it earlier. I think it would be a bit of a stretch to have a neurophysiology of packaging just yet. So this will be about the only brain I share in the presentation. We'll have a slight change of focus, if you will, from what we've seen, very interesting, this morning. I want to look a little bit about the insights for healthy eating that come from a multisensory approach for experimental psychology, a neuroscience-inspired approach to better food, packaging, branding, and experiences, based on the idea the emerging trend in neuroscience of the senses that we can't really think about hearing, vision, touch, taste, and smell as independent. All the time they're communicating one with another, and hence whenever we eat something or experience something, it's really the product of multisensory integration. And the challenge for me and my colleagues is to try and take the insights that are emerging from the neuroscience, from single cell neurophysiology of sensory integration, and try and see how they might pan out and apply to delivering foods that are healthier, or that give you whole new taste sensations, things that consumers have never experienced before. And today I'd just like to give you sort of three kind of classes of examples of the sort of work we and others do in this area under the kind of grand title of neurogastronomy. Take that or not as you will, but the three areas I think that are most exciting to us are looking at the multisensory design of products that either taste the same, but where we've reduced the health harmful ingredients and use psychology illusions to keep the flavor percept constant but the bad stuff out. I want to look a bit at packaging because I think that's a very important but understudied part of food experience. And finally, a couple of examples looking at the role of place, so the three P's, product, packaging, and place, or atmospherics if you're into marketing. And the work we do is all funded by industry, and it stretches from the kind of flavour manufacturers on the left, people like Quest, Givaudan, Firmenich, and Takasago, who make most of the flavours and the foods and drinks that you eat, be it in restaurants or purchased from the supermarket, through to the kind of providers of goods in the supermarkets, Unilever's, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Britvic for those in the UK, Mars, Flavia, Thornton's Chocolates, and so on. And then through to kind of those who deliver experiences to consumers, be it your coffee at Starbucks, your burger at McDonald's, or from that bottom end up to the top end of kind of some of the world's best restaurants like the Fat Duck in Bray. We work with them trying to figure out how the psychology and the neuroscience can be applied to develop more exciting taste and flavour experiences. So to start, the sort of things that are getting the flavour companies very excited is kind of the idea of sort of super additivity, that if they're trying to deliver a flavour to a client, They can do so more cheaply by understanding how the brain combines tastes and smells. And this is some lovely work from Pam Dalton and colleagues at Monell Chemical Senses illustrating the idea. Namely that if you're trying to detect a flavour, call it a sweet almond from Bakewell Tart will be kind of the most common example. Then if you vary kind of the intensity, you can get the subjective threshold so that people can't really tell which bottle has that scent of almond in it. Then put a drop of sugar or saccharin on a person's tongue and suddenly that flavour becomes much more intense and perceptible to the consumer. If you're a Western, North American, European consumer, it's only saccharin on the tongue that does this, so a odourless tastant enhancing the flavour or the aroma percept. MSG on the right has no effect. So this allows the flavour companies to start delivering flavours more cheaply by getting the right sort of combination of smell and taste, figuring out which combinations deliver those super additive, if you will, kind of flavour sensations. It's also of interest to them because if you go cross-culturally, if you go to Japan, you find that there the Japanese brain doesn't seem to integrate saccharin and benzaldehyde in quite the same way. Instead, the Japanese brain prefers the combination of MSG, giving it a boost of the almond flavour, presumably because of the kind of foods and the diets that Japanese and North American consumers have been exposed to. In the West, it's much more common to have the sweet almond dessert, whereas in Japan, it's much more common to have the pickled condiments that would have the MSG and almond odour. So the same rules, but different combinations of ingredients delivering those flavour hits that people are searching for. To move to the sort of the Unilevers and Procter & Gambles, they're very interested in trying to keep the flavour profiles of their products constant, but reduce the harmful ingredients, sugar, salt, fat, and so on. And we've done quite a lot of work with them, trying to help them achieve that objective, sometimes successful, often not. The sort of work we do is starts in the lab with, say, looking at the effect of colour. Can we deliver sweetness to a consumer through their eyes rather than their tongue? Are there certain colours that convey a set of expectations about sweetness in the mind of the consumer, such that certain drinks that you see there on the counter would be judged as subjectively sweeter if we get the colour right? The answer turns out to be yes. And in particular, the colours of ripe fruits, perhaps not surprisingly, are the ones that seem to drive sweetness perception in the consumers that we test. And that if you get the colour just right, you can expect to increase perceived sweetness by about 11%. And this is more than just kind of a psychological trick. If you give people the drink that is less sweet but has the right colour versus another drink that has more sweetness, more calories, but the wrong colour, and get them to try and judge which one is the sweeter, they're kind of indistinguishable in their subjective or perceptible sweetness, but one has less calories than the other. Of course, you might have to do the same thing for salt, reduce salt in the diet, but there it's much harder to think what to do, because it seems that our brains are picking up the correlations in nature that fruits go from green to orange through to red, and that correlation's picked up, driving sweetness. So when it comes to reducing salt in a food, well, what exactly colour correlates with saltiness? It's much harder to say, and hence many of the food companies are struggling with using colour in that regard. They can change sweetness, but not saltiness perception. Why they're also interested, the Unilevers and the like, is because of sort of segmenting populations, markets. It turns out some of us are super tasters, having tongues that look more like the blown-up sample on the bottom right. Others are non-tasters with the kind of flabby taste buds more widely dispersed that we see on the top on the right. About a quarter of the population of each, and half the population somewhere medium tasters in the middle. And that increased number of taste buds will correlate with, they're not quite the same thing as, increased sensitivity to bitterness in foods, in coffee, broccoli, and so on, cruciferous vegetables, and also perhaps relate to your sensitivity to fat in salad dressings and ice creams. And in certain markets where these food companies operate, it turns out there are far more super tasters than elsewhere, and a number of their new products are failing because they taste too bitter to their target audience, consumers in that country. So now they're increasingly releasing products targeted to different taster statuses, whether the consumer knows that or not. And it turns out those who are super tasters, with tongues like on the bottom right, will also be less influenced by the colour of food. It's as if they trust their tongues more, whereas those who are non-tasters, it would appear, are much more driven by what they see. Their tongues aren't giving them such good information, and hence they're more visually dominant, and hence you can expect to deliver more visual sweetness to a non-taster than to a super-taster. So our work
looks then at what psychology and neuroscience can help to preserve or change flavors for these companies. But increasingly we're looking at the area of packaging, something that hasn't been studied that much to date. And if you see the adverts, this one from Barcelona Airport for Ben & Jerry's ice cream, 99% pleasure, the rest is in the carton. Utterly misleading, I'd say far more than 1% is really in the carton. And so by knowing how the packaging influences your perception of the food you buy in the supermarkets and elsewhere, you can also hope to enhance the flavour, change the percept. And this is really building on old marketing research going back as far as the 1950s from Louis Cheskin in New York, who have studies showing that if you change the colour of a can of 7-Up, say, it appeared to change how lemony or limey it was. At the time, people didn't understand it. It made no sense. Why are consumers so silly that changing the colour of the can changes the taste? And what we think is maybe it's kind of a sensory dominance effect, that when you're drinking from the can, you can't see the product inside, and hence you get dominance from the colour of the can in this case. And I could point you to orange juice manufacturers in the Netherlands who now deliberately change the colour of their orange juice packaging to change your perception of the acidity of the juice within. So colouring can impact, and you might think then perhaps Coca-Cola is a particularly good example, bright red colour, maybe giving you more sweetness. But it gets a bit more complicated, because what you're doing in the marketplace is always trying to capture the attention of the consumer, and hence you see products like the Gatorade Cool Blue Raspberry, trying to capture your attention by being a unique blue thing in amongst all those fruit colours. And what we're seeing in our lab work is now that those colours that are introduced into the marketplace are affecting the associations and the expectations of the consumers that we test. So that now, if we go to young British consumers and they see a blue drink like that, they'll expect that colour, before they've ever tasted anything, to be something like raspberry. They've learned that unnatural association. Whereas go to Taiwan, exactly the same colour in a drink is associated with mint instead. And from the work of Martin Yeoman speaking later, we can anticipate what effects that will have when expectation is confirmed or disconfirmed on the pleasantness of their sensation thereafter. I'll just leave you mentioning in passing, there's a lot more that can go on, not just the colour of the food itself, but the colours and the shapes on the packaging. You might wonder why it is that San Pellegrino has angular red stars on the front, on the top, on the back, on the sides of its bottle. Never thought about it before, but they've been there since at least 1907. Up on Arias Water has the same thing, red triangles brightly displayed. Heineken Beer has just launched its new logo with a bright red star. What are they up to? I'd say it's kind of sound symbolism at work, that they're setting up expectations about the likely taste and oral somatosensory attributes of the food inside. And again, just like the colour, the more that your expectations are met, even at this kind of subconscious level by shape, the better the thing will taste. And there's work showing that is, in fact, the case. Moving to sound, I think there's also a place there for neuroscience, showing how important sound is to our perception of crispness, crunchiness. This is probably my most infamous study with Max Zampini in our gold soundproof booth, when our participants, not really the right thing for an obesity conference, would have to consume, or bite into at least, 180 Pringles, one after the other. And we systematically change the sound of the Pringles as they bit into them, one by one, sometimes boosting the sound, sometimes cutting it, and playing with the frequency profile of the sound they heard online. And for this, we won the Ig Nobel for nutrition in 2008, showing that we could, in fact, modulate crispness by about 15% by getting the sound right. And of course, this is psychologically induced crispness, but now the food companies like Nestle, Procter & Gamble, and Unilever are all using this kind of psychological tests in-house for their modification, updating of their dry food products. And hence, you can think about better cooking techniques, but keeping the crunchiness sound, but lowering the fat. And going back to the packaging again, then you think, well, why are crisps sold in such noisy packets? Is it something about the preservation properties? No, it's not. According to the packaging engineers, it's just some marketeer's intuition that a noisy packet sets up the right expectations again for a noisy food that can, probably has been taken to excess. If you come across the Sun Chips, they're about 120 decibels when you try and pick up these packets. Launched in Canada and the States last year, big public outcry. They then went online saying you could send in for some earplugs when you eat your crisps. So things can go too far in terms of the modulation of the packaging, but I think the idea is right that what you hear will, in fact, again, influence your Christmas perception by about 7% less than when you change the product, but still significant. And you can do the same thing for carbonation, too. It's partly about what you hear. And, of course, carbonic acid is going to rot your teeth, so psychological interventions might help. And I'll just leave you with a couple of sort of examples of the tactile attributes of packaging, what's going on there. Partly a lot of work on sort of the associations we have with particular shapes as a function of the market you're in. People like Covent Garden's doing a great job in kind of promoting soup sales by piggybacking on the associations the UK consumer has with this Tetra Pak, normally what milk comes in, fresh, natural product. And here they've got into those, all those associations by the shape and the way you open this packaging, and hence these sort of products will taste better. And in terms of fruit drinks, a lot of work going on tactile feel. So you're serving fruit drinks, would they taste fruitier, better? Would people be more likely to drink them if you give them a surface texture? This is the best example from a Japanese designer, but other versions are possible and being worked on at this time. And finally, just thinking about the environment, the multisensory attributes of the environment, what can they do? Then we've done work showing that playing the sound of the sea when you eat seafood will enhance the experience. People enjoy their seafood more if you get the right sort of atmospheric cues. In terms of healthy eating, I think some very exciting work, not really done with health in mind, but showing the impact of more semantically meaningful, either visual or auditory attributes. Everything from playing the French or German music in the supermarket, completely changing sales of French and German wine. Because the consumers will tell you, no, that music didn't influence me, and yet the figures show a very different story. And if it's not just the music, it's also the visual attributes, be it the colour of the tablecloth, the bottle of wine on the table, the Italian flag, has an equally profound effect on modulating food choice. So here we have both the auditory, visual, and olfactory attributes of the environment work to direct people to perhaps more healthy or less healthy eating choices, whether they realise it or not. So I'll leave it there, but I hope to have convinced you of the kind of the potential importance of knowing about the brain and psychology for the better design of healthier foods, packaging, and environments.
Really nice and interesting talk. Are there any questions? Stephanie?
Very nice talk, very interesting. It just really underscores the importance of the cues and properties that are associated with food and how it really contributes to eating behavior. And so I'm curious about your thoughts on, there's a bit of a debate in the epidemiology world about really the contribution of media and packaging of food to the increase in obesity we've been seeing, and that some epidemiologists think we're really paying too much attention to the marketing aspects and not giving much attention to other environmental variables. What are your thoughts on this, and how much do you think this is really, this increase in the advertising and packaging and all the other aspects is going into the increase in caloric consumption?
I'm not sure. From my work with some of the food companies, I see them moving a lot more now to sort of getting their portion sizes, be it chocolate bars, below the kind of the 100 calorie mark. So there's a lot of work going on there trying to figure out how you can, they use sort of a vertical horizontal illusion, say, how you can present the food in order to give illusions of volume so consumers don't feel like they're losing out, even when you're bringing the calorie and the size of the chocolate bar down. So I've seen examples even as simple as, take it for sort of Kit Kat, their work. When you decide we have two little Kit Kat bars, end on end or side by side, on one level it shouldn't matter at all, but people's perception of how much chocolate they're eating differs quite a lot. In those two cases. In terms of the packaging, I think there are some sort of new technologies, packaging technologies, encapsulation techniques coming onto the market now and getting ever cheaper that maybe allow some of the food companies to deliver, again, use the packaging in a more
productive way to enhance the flavour experience without the calorific input. That's a very early stages so far. If I'm thinking about sort of the taste, you can embed tastes now in the lip or cup or the part of a receptacle that touches the tongue. You can have a sort of scent release from the lid, all sorts of things that might help to deliver better flavours. On the advertising side, I'm not so sure.
I was wondering if the food industry isn't in a type of conflict of interest, trying to, on one side, maximize the consumption, and how ethics plays into this. I have a hard time.
Yep. So when the CRISP work came out, had a lot of comments from the media saying, "Oh, isn't this sort of evil? All those food companies are going to start selling us really out of date crisps, but just have the sound right, and no one will notice." So I think there's always a potential possibility of manipulation in the marketplace. But from at least some of the food companies I have worked with, they seem to have taken very much on board internally the idea of sort of the healthy consumer, and the longer they can keep their consumers alive, the longer they set their sale, they'll keep buying their products. and that's sort of, what people like Unilever, for example, a lot of work on sort of the brain-enhancing margarines and all sorts of stuff. So I think they're... some of them at least, are very serious about keeping their consumers alive, and so they don't see it as such a conflict to others.
So just a quick sort of follow-up to that. I mean, one of the concerns that I have with all this is essentially the food companies are generating super agonists, so anything that, for example, is a natural food then becomes less and less close to what this heightened reality is. Don't you think that might have some really negative long-term consequences for eating like real food?
In some of the work that we do with chefs, they're very concerned about artificial additives and such like. But you can do many of the same tricks just naturally. So one of the dishes on the fat duck is kind of the beetroot and orange jelly. And there you're playing with colour again. The waiter will come with this orange and beetroot, purple-coloured jelly, and say, "We recommend you start with the beetroot. Where will you go but to the purple thing?" Because it turns out the beetroot's been cooked, it loses its purple colour, it becomes orange, and blood red oranges or ruby oranges, purple to begin with. So kind of some of the tricks you use here needn't involve, it's kind of orthogonal to some degree, the artificiality and the kind of use of psychology. And there's kind of a question about, it's very easy to show some of these effects in the lab, how would they pan out in the marketplace over the long term? Surely consumers might just learn that isn't really a sweet. So I guess from work on sort of low-calorie foods, the brain seems to pick up. It's not getting what it wants. But we've done some work on coloured sweets to suggest that these kind of visual dominance of flavour can last for decades.
Question, and I'll encourage everybody else to...
And really, I suppose I'd add to that, just thinking about the ageing population, increasing amounts of work there for people who've lost their sense of taste, losing their sense of smell at 70, there is no other... In a way, root, you can't do anything to the mouth, and colour and sound and texture cues provide maybe one of the only ways for keeping food exciting.
A brief comment and a question for you, John. The comment is the following. If you look at the two panels we had before, the one on reward, the one on the hypothalamus, and we see how much of eating is is tied to biological processes, to reward response, and how challenging is the deliberation, the reasoning, and the thinking. I just happen to believe that we are at a given point in time in modernity, and where do we go from there? And I think that the notion of on purpose, bringing the whole knowledge of brain, food, and gene to see to what extent we can shape the food supply in as a health-promoting direction as possible. I think that this is an important move if we are to stop preaching and get behavioral change. My question to you is, you give advice to the food manufacturing, but what advice would you give to nutrition and population health that are often going on the other extreme, like giving the nutritional value and therefore the world should behave? What advice would you give to their product?
Some of the food companies I work with support some of the top chefs, either explicitly or not, and with the idea there sort of trying to change people's behaviour or perception of response to food, rather than preaching. One of the best ways is through the media and TV chefs, quite an excellent route into changing the way we think about food. So people like Blumenthal maybe has been funded by Firmenich and gives people a whole new perception on sort of science and food. It's not always necessarily an evil combination. It can be interesting. So that seems to be one successful route to changing behaviour. In terms of kind of the labelling and naming, that's very interesting too, but something we're only just starting to look at the minute.
I'd like to thank Charles Spence for a great talk and a nice discussion. Thank you.